Yeah, listen, one more.
Yeah, music appreciation with Two-Edged Soldier.
Yeah. Oh. No way.
No way.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy, and God, I know I'm one. Wicked and wild, like a West Texas wind, born to be an only rebel child.
So you just want to get to business straight away? Should we just jump in? No dilly dally. Andrew's falling asleep on us. Right? You with us, Andrew?
It's
with
late, us? Guys. It's late. It's
Andrew's Sunday using night. The Google.
Yeah,
I'm using the Google.
All right. Well, let's go into it then. In the previous session, we established a working knowledge of Meredith Klein's covenant theology. However, the next step for us now is to offer something of a dialectical analysis of what has been described. Hello.
I feel like I've hurt your feelings.
This is why we've got to banter our way in. Otherwise, it's just like, you know.
Yeah, but the problem
come
is,
brothers,
Mike,
let us
pre-record.
Yeah,
pre-record. You guys who are like fresh morning chickens.
We're not fresh.
We've been bantering
for
the last hour. We've been on call for like an hour already. That's what I'm saying.
We've just been saying hi. Don't be so mean.
This is what tired Andre sounds like.
Just be friendly.
Not tired, Andre.
Now we know
this
what your wife has to put
Andre.
Up with.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, we want to keep this lively because, I mean, it is, you know, we want to in this session look at Klein's response to theonomy, right? So
this is like where the atom bomb falls.
Yeah, this is the atom bomb. We don't want to fall asleep on this chapter. You know,
I definitely don't, which is why we need to get going.
All right, I'm going.
The fuse is burning down.
That's what I'm saying. We're going.
My kids are sleeping. My wife is sleeping. I'm nearly there. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So in all seriousness, we're moving forward. We've covered the covenant of grace. We've sort of established something in terms of a working knowledge of Klein, hopefully. If not in the last three sessions, then in this podcast in general. So hopefully people have been looking and listening and we're able to move forward now. But for anyone that is tracking with us in the book, the next thing that happens is that the actual sort of meat of the book starts coming into play in there. You sort of put all the working parts together, but now it's like, what has Klein said about all these other covenantal things going on? And then what have they said to him in return, and who's right and who's wrong, basically. So that's a bit of a journey, as it's put in the book, a dialectical analysis. So we have to kind of maybe take it in little chunks and move our way forward, because we might want to add a few things here and there, and we'll do it
inevitably.
So we'll try and touch, you know, on the substance of at least that part of the chapter. And in chapter four, it goes through the theonomist, you know, critique, and then the perspectivalist critique, and each one of those things are kind of like meaty, and then the Dovidian critique also. So, you know, we won't be able to do that all in one. I don't think we're even going to try. So we'll do theonomists this time, perspectivalists the next time, and Dovidians finally, and then we'll go reverse and do them, you know, against Klein.
I got a question.
What is theonomy,
Mike? That was my question.
Yeah, let's start with thinking about what exactly. I mean, again, I think most people have a handle on this if they're listening. It's not like it requires a lot of explanation, but a little synopsis is a good thing. I think that one thing I like to, okay, just in there, because we're probably going to beat down on the theonomists pretty hard. So one way I like to start this whole thing is just go, okay, listen, I get that theonomy in general theos, namas. So you've just got God's law. And as a very broad sort of, you know, cry, it's just, hey, we don't have autonomy. We're under God, you know? And, you know, let's just state up front that we're all in agreement with that concept. No one wants autonomy from God. That's where the rhetoric goes. You know, oh, you're just trying to, you know, the common grace covenant is just one big attempt at trying to, you know, join the pagans and in being autonomous from God and so forth, and having your life set apart from him and airtight from your religious categories and so forth. But let's just state up front that no, we like that part of theonomy. Like theonomy, you know, as a concept of not being autonomous, but theonomous is fine. No one's got a problem with that. But we're talking now about the specific development that has taken place in reform thinking as a kind of fundamentalism, you might say, that is like a backlash against the way that Western society has been drifting and has used the Bible in an inappropriate way to fight back, you know, particularly on this issue of the Mosaic covenant. They've looked at parts of the Old Testament, and they've said, okay, we'll just use that to inform our politics, and that's going to be our fight back as really fundamentalists ultimately. But also, you know, they're appealing to the Reformed tradition. So what makes them so difficult to work with is that they go, we're just saying what the Westminster said. We're just saying what Calvin said. We're just saying what the Puritans said. And then you go looking into it and you're like, oh, geez, maybe they have a point, you know, because it does feel like a lot of those things were very similar.
Yeah.
But even there, we have to just say, you know, we're not, yes, there was a lot of similarities and overlap, but even there, we have to be really careful, because what we're saying, we're talking about now in theonomy, is not as theocratic as those other things might have been, those other versions like Puritanism and Calvin or whatever. They were not doing what theonomists are doing. They're not looking, you know, they weren't looking at the Mosaic law and going, there we go, there's our model for politics. Calvin at his worst was going, in common grace we have this great big, you know, examples of equitable principles, should I say, of things in the Mosaic covenant. So we can look at the way they did that and then read that through the rubric of common grace and then apply it. But I mean, Calvin himself was militantly against, you know, anyone that even tried to move in a hermeneutical direction that theonomists did. And so was Kuyper. And so was, you know, all these patron saints that they appealed to were all actually against them on the actual hermeneutic, which is where it gets, you know,
Calvin would call them Judaizers.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And, you know, it just swore at them a few times, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, not theonomists, but, you know, the proto theonomists back in the day.
Yeah. And I think there is an important sociological aspect that we have to bring in, because theonomy there's a sociological dynamic which has caused theonomy.
Yes.
So because of the drift of the West away from its Christian roots, because of the challenge of modern civilization, you know, where it's trying to dismantle Christianity, firstly modernism and then postmodernism, mm-hmm. there's this reaction on the part of theonomists.
Yeah.
We want to hold on to that Christian heritage, that establishment that has been built up, the long years of Christian history that have been given to us. And then in the mix, another sociological aspect that needs to be thought of is that dispensationalism.
Yes.
With its radical discontinuity. Yeah. So you, on the one hand, you've got culture going crazy. Mm. On the other hand, the main Christian voice is, you know, the loudest voice in America at the time was dispensational and discontinuity. And so reaction.
And not only that, but that conservative voice, you know, fundamentalist voice was largely dispensational. Yeah. So, and they're as loudly as they're shouting against the culture, they're shouting some really weird, you know, this, you know, segmented form of theology that the reform guys are like, what the heck? What are we going to do?
Wrong
with this?
Answer. He has a better
exactly,
answer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So enter Murray. And he's like, no.
Well, hang on a sec, Mark. Before we enter Murray, is it fair to say that one of the other problems with the whole discussion is that even by appealing to the reformers and even by appealing to the Puritans, actually that's not altogether helpful, because both the reformers and the Puritans were at a particular, I love the way you say sociological, Nick, just say it one more time for me.
Sociological.
That's brilliant. Okay. So like at a particular stage in history where in order to help the kind of religious ideas, they also needed to forge some kind of politic to protect it. Because, you know, if you take the reformers, you know, without the German princes, Luther would have had a real problem. So the kind of the Reformation theology and the need to partner with the authorities, you know, they needed the secular authority. So there was always this kind of, in the discussion, they were kind of at the same time reviving, you know, reviving theological ideas, biblical ideas, retrieving original Christianity, but they were also trying to do that within a kind of political landscape that would allow them to do it, would protect them. And then you go to the Puritans and they're the same, like, you know, they're busy overthrowing
Henry
the monarchy,
the imposition of Rome,
that's right, you got all the Charleses, you got all that kind of thing going on. They're trying to establish a parliament that will protect their religious freedom as well. Mm-hmm. So going to those two movements, while obviously we are in the Reformed tradition, obviously we want to go back to the Reformers and we want to go back to the Puritans as kind of post-Reformation Reformers, but theologically, but we have to bear in mind the context, and their context and our context is not the same, nor would we necessarily want to retrieve it. Is it fair to say that that's got to be a factor in the way that we're retrieving Reformation theology for this discussion?
It saves us from anachronism.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely, that's true, without a doubt. And not only that, I mean, I suppose as Baptists, we're particularly sensitive to that point as well, just going, you know, hey, there has been a little bit of progression of thought since then. So we get that, you know, perhaps you had to baptize babies just to like keep your passport and stuff and citizenship and whatnot. But, you know, then things have happened and we just need to rethink, you know, just how, you know, we don't have the same level of excuse at some point. But you know, even deeper than that is what we were saying earlier, I think, in that, let's say you don't even take that into consideration. Let's just say you go, all right, let's say we try and establish our friendships with the monarchies that be today. And we do exactly the same sort of thing to, you know, protect our religious freedom. Even then, the way that they would go about it is not what the Theonomists were doing or are doing now. You know, they are appealing not to Israel as this like exemplary point in political history, you know, but rather for the church, especially, but rather they're saying it is unique, unrepeatable, and so forth. And, you know, they're acknowledging the unique nature of the Mosaic covenant on elements of theocracy. And then they're just going, yet we also see in the Bible, equitable principle all over the place. So we can look at that. So they were just a little more zealous and ready to do that than we are, I suppose, is one way to put it. But that's different from with theocracy, with theonomy, at least. I mean, that's not what they're doing. They're not just saying, they're saying, you know, no, there is a complete continuity in the covenants. To be in the new covenant is to be in the Mosaic covenant come to its own, you know, which is really like a different kettle of fish entirely. But we'll get there in a second with the covenantal juncture points.
So in your book, Mike, you talk about some key names. You got Rushdoony, son-in-law North, and Barnson. And then you talk about basically the context being set through Murray's revisionism.
Yeah.
Shepherd's monocovenantalism, Barnson's support, and then this is the point at which Klein then basically feels he has to step in and make his response.
Yeah, because we were saying, like, you know, there's all this dispensational stuff happening, and so part of it is this like drift of Western society. Another part is what is Reformed theology saying to conservative evangelical dispensationalism? You know, how is it responding? And so Murray himself starts to say, hey, I realize I'm in the revisionist camp here, but I think we need to like up our game with continuity, you know? So he's the one sort of just wanting to get those points of discontinuity away. And then, you know, I mean, we all like Murray. Murray's a good guy. So, and, you know, great books and great stuff on everything. But he did just set this thing in play. I think it's easy enough to see now that created trouble, you know, certainly by the time of Shepherd, you know, where he goes, oh, actually, if you want to be consistent with what Murray was saying, let's just like iron this out even more. And then, oh, wow, we don't even have a law grace contrast anymore. Oh, wow. What are we doing with justification? Oh, maybe we should focus more on what James was saying. And so it goes, you know, and it basically all comes out of this whole thing. Like, it's the more you turn the Old Covenant and New Covenant into one continuous, you know, without any discontinuity thing. You're taking the concept of law and gospel away. You're putting them in a continuum rather than a contrast. And if you do that, then the next thing to go is justification, because the whole concept of a principle of merit falls. And therefore, who needs to earn merit to begin with? It's not a matter of doing what Israel failed to do anymore. Now it's a matter of just persevering, you know, in the grace already given to receive the reward that we would, you know, earn in our perseverance. And so you can see how that sort of process.
I think I find myself cursing Murray once a day.
Yeah,
you know, he's,
and that's big coming from you, because you used to be a real Murray fan as well.
Yeah, because he tried to reframe it as an Adamic administration. He tried to draw on older categories of the covenant of creation, anything to just sort of remove the strong contrast between works and grace, and because he wanted a more of a mix going on there.
Mm.
And he's just cast the mold for all dialogue since then, because most people don't have the historical roots of the discussion and the importance of those categories.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of think they're following someone reliable when they follow Murray.
Yes, exactly.
Because that's how I felt. I mean, here's a guy who's reliable. I mean, Westminster, Philadelphia. I mean, come on, you couldn't ask for more. That's the bastion of orthodoxy right there.
Right.
And if Murray said it, well, I'll side with Murray against you, and I'm on the better side, you know?
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that he's thrown his name behind such a bad problem.
Yes. You know, and to be fair to Murray, I mean, I didn't think he didn't see it. Like, you know, it became a thing after him, I think. Yeah. You know, it wasn't.
He set it up.
Yeah, he set it up, and he was just trying to do what theologians do. But it just basically reinforces the point. Everyone's got to think this thing through. You can't rely on, you know, it's everyone's job to really think. And certainly when a counterpoint is made, like, so when it does evolve into the whole shepherd problem, and then the Bonson sort of jump on the bandwagon, merge into theonomy controversy, and then you got a guy like Klein making a response saying, whoa, you know, hang on now, you know, let's just go way back on this and let's pull this monstrosity apart. Especially then, I mean, it really becomes us to go, okay, wait a minute. Yeah, I'm not going to just keep going with Murray at that point. You know, you've got to rethink the whole thing. When it starts merging with the same thing with Van Til, right? There's this kind of like interesting correspondence, I find, like, in that you couldn't really see where it was all going, you know, and then even Van Til himself doesn't really get into the thing, because, you know, Bonson publishes his book, Theonomy and Christian Ethics, what was it, like a few years after Van Til retired, right? But I mean, it's just unmistakable. Like, as you read all these guys, like, you know, Rashtuni, and, you know, they're all disciples of Van Til. So it's like, where there's smoke, there must be fire, you know. Now, it's true that there were also other guys that didn't go in that direction, but it's just like, whew, you know, it sort of has that same sense of Murrayan sauce to me, you know. So you have to just watch out for that sort of thing. And even if they themselves weren't trying to advocate a certain direction, when it does move in that direction, you know, like now we see a little bit more than they could see. We got to stop and just, when there's been you know, some backlash, just rethink the whole thing. You can't just keep going with it just because, you know,
Rashtuni is the guy that James White was so into, right? Is it Rashtuni? Was James White and Jeff Durbin?
They were, yes. Yeah, well, I don't know.
Institute of Biblical Law is sort of his making of
They went to, exactly.
And there's some really good stuff in there. I mean, it's very insightful exegesis of some aspects of the law. It's quite compelling.
As with Bonson,
he's the guy who revived homeschooling as part of a reformed distinctive. So if you're part of the modern homeschooling movement, you can thank Rashtuni
and Doug Wilson.
Well, Doug Wilson's popularized the classical model.
The classical side, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
ooh, that's hard. That's hard to do. Hard to thank Rashtuni. and so what were we saying before that, though?
So we were just looking at Murray's revision, Shepherd's monocovenantalism, Bonson's support, and then Klein's response.
What point did you make, though, Andrew? What was the thing?
James White.
Oh, James White. Yes, yes. That's really interesting. You were saying there's a lot of insight in Rashtuni's, you know, work. And it's the same thing with Bonson. I mean, like, it is quite surprising. You read Bonson's, I mean, like, I didn't want to have to read all of Bonson's stuff, but like, I had to get through it. And I was actually quite amazed at how it was really quite balanced, and, you know, it was, you know, and again, like, it's coming back to the opening point, you know, there is this we're all reformed, and you got to remember that. And there's like this agreement, and so much like the and the, you know, you have the best and the worst proponents of each movement, and you know, you're going to have people that cloak their theology to do other things. They don't care about Christianity on the two kingdom side or the theonomy side. So, you know, you always got to remember that. And it's not just a, you know, I'm convinced, like, you know, Bunsen was like a very, very, I mean, he cared about the word of God. You know, he just desperately wanted to do this thing, and he was convinced. But and you know, you can really benefit from reading a lot of what he's saying. I mean, he's just a sharp guy. I like the way he teams up with Frame to like bag teams up with Klein to bag Frame, though. You know, he's like again, Klein and I both agree that this is whatever Frame's doing is just complete madness. But anyway, so you know, we've got to just make sure to not overplay the whole, you know, Bunsen's the devil kind of thing, and you know, that's not what's happening.
I've got his lectures on Western philosophy, outstanding. I read them on apologetics all the time, outstanding. Yes.
And so, and the same would be for Jeff Durbin, the same would be James White, and you know, these are all brothers doing their thing, but I we just really, really genuinely disagree with where they've come, you know, and not just with them, but with them as Klein does. You know, we just think, hey, you've missed something here, and this is leading you in a really weird direction. So it would be so cool if you could just see that, and then we could just talk about that. So it's not a hate thing. It's just a, you know, hey, we disagree thing. And maybe I mentioned that as well, because one of the things that happens, I think, becomes so obvious in this whole period with the Klein versus Bunsen thing. And Klein wasn't necessarily above reproach on this either. You know, they just
wasn't the best critic.
Yeah. Everyone's just shouting at each other, you know, just, you monstrous this and And like, I get it. Everyone's angry. It's about justification, but it's just like, it's not going to work to do it that way, you know? And so we just got to hear it, and we got to listen, and we got to go, here's where I actually disagree, and so forth. And because the problem is, it always stems, this sort of thing stems from something that the government has done wrong already. So there's already a kind of like aggro that is attached to this.
Ready to be triggered. Yeah.
The reason that I'm holding this theonomy is because I'm already triggered on this thing that, you know, is now happening. And any poor soul that tries to get in the way of this is just, you know, so I don't know. It our only, yeah, exactly, work. So, and you know, your only hope at that point, I mean, you could shout back and go, I'm not freaking work, you know, so whatever. Or you could just go, you know, this, let's just try and reason this out and just act in a way that sort of calms the whole process and just moves everyone a little bit closer to what would be healthy, even if we're not going to find total agreement on this, which we're probably not, but just to edge our way toward the center would be good. I think that would be a good result. Yeah. So for example, you got Shepherd that comes along, right? And he's like, okay, listen, we're revising the whole thing. The problem is that we have not been monocovenantal enough. So here we go. Here's the full system. There it is. That's why I'm compromising on sola fide, because our covenant theology has led us wrongly to believe in sola fide as it has been traditionally formulated. And then Bunsen, you know, hops on that bandwagon by the end of his writing ministry and really his life. It really becomes clear that that's his position. And then what happens is that, well, even though that was like, what, 40, 50 years ago, whatever, that is something that simmers, right? Because now you mentioned Westminster, Philadelphia, Westminster, California, and you got all these like little groups that are developing, and it's, you know, everyone's behaving, but it's sort of just waiting for its next opportunity to lash out, because the issue is simmering still. And the question behind the question is, how the heck do we interpret the Mosaic Covenant? What do we do with the Mosaic Covenant? Yeah. That becomes the simmering issue. That's what's going to explode if you don't sort of have your head around this at some level. And what the thing I most appreciate about Klein's response is the way that he gets to that point.
Right.
For sure.
So just backtracking a little bit, right? You said that a lot of this has to do with sola fide and revising it and challenging prevailing understanding of what sola fide means and that kind of thing. So like, in what way? Like, is this, you know, because obviously later on you've got Federal Vision stuff happening as well, which is also like another challenge to sola fide, which is building on or connected to the New Perspective on Paul stuff, which is also kind of like in some way a challenge on Reformation stuff. So like, so what we're saying is that actually there are these different understandings of sola fide, within the Reformed world that should be tolerated as equally part of the Reformed world?
Well, they didn't tolerate Shepherd. They kicked him out for that. So that's good.
Yeah, for sure. No, you know, okay.
So
yeah,
it was not toleration to that extent, which is, you know, I think everyone can have a sigh of relief in that regard. But the issue is simmering still. That's the thing. Because then you have, you basically have Frame come along and go, no, no, well, I mean, guys, everyone misunderstood Shepherd. And then you can see, once you get into what he's saying, you can see why he would say that, because he basically holds the same view, you know? And so how did that happen? And then, yeah, there's this whole sort of thing that is still lurking. Yeah.
But like, what are we talking about? Like, what kind of variation? What kind of...
Well, so how it works is, whenever you have anything monocovenantal, you know, focus falls away from Adam's failure under a merit principle, right?
Yeah.
So they're basically, the first thing that needed to happen was that Adam needed to earn his way into, under this covenantal arrangement. That is, of course, God condescending to make an arrangement and so forth. But in this arrangement, he had to work to enter into rest, right? And then, you know, so, and why this is important, and we'll, you know, well, let me just tell you why it's important. I'll come back and say why it's not always the most intuitive thing to grasp, because, you know, if you start in the beginning of the Bible, you might not get this until you've got to Romans and so forth. But when you get to Romans, you see, okay, wait a minute, there's this parallel between the first Adam and the second Adam. And the second Adam, of course, is Jesus. So then the question becomes, when Jesus was praying to the Father and saying, all right, now I've done the work that you've given me, you know, please give it to me by grace. I don't really deserve it, but could you give it to me anyway? You know, as something that is loving on your part that I don't really deserve. That's really what you're saying he would have had to pray. He didn't pray that, of course. He goes, I've done the work. Now give to me that which you have promised before, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so you've got this clear sort of parallel. Paul obviously draws that out. You've got the reason why we have grace is because Christ has done the work to enter us, enter into rest. And therefore we get what he worked for. Salvation is always by works, except it's the work of another, right? And so we have it freely by grace. So any attempt to lessen that basically means you take focus away from Adam's failure originally. Okay. And you say, it's, you know, it's less a matter of Adam had to work to get into this thing, and more he already had it. God had given to, you know, everything to him. It was just persevere in the obedience of the faith, you know, to receive the gracious gift that you don't deserve from the beginning anyway, in eternal life, you know. So you just have to, you know, covenantal gnomism, really. It's just you just got
in by grace. You keep yourself in by law. It's more an issue of congruent than condign merit.
Yes. Yeah. So you know, grace constitutes, and then the law just kind of regulates the whole thing as you go forward. So then you get to Jesus, and what was he doing exactly? You know, well, active obedience goes out the window immediately. Why would he need to, you know, he's just doing that as well, you know? And so he just becomes this, you've got a way to hold passive obedience in play. You know, he's dying for our sins, but he certainly isn't working for our justification. Because that's, you know, already, we're already in that. So it's a matter of just kind of, you know, following along. Yeah. And
it's worth just underlining that again, Mike, that if you didn't deny the merit principle and the covenant of works for Adam in the garden, you're denying the imputation of the active obedience of Christ in justification. That's the implication.
Yeah. Sorry, my dog's barking. So if I cut out you.
Yeah.
Did you hear that? Do you hear the dog barking?
No.
Okay. I think it's Satan's attack on that point.
Shall I say it again?
Yeah. Say it.
So if you get rid of the merit principle and the covenant of works for Adam in the garden,
yes,
you have to get rid of the active obedience of Christ, which is imputed to us for justification.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those two aspects stand all together.
And now this is the thing. Klein, and this is why he was so voracious, by the way. This is why, you know, his rhetoric was what it was, because he saw this as a really, really, really terrible attack on the gospel at that level. Because what you say about the Mosaic covenant, if you desire works, I'm sorry, deny a works principle there, right? That is going to degenerate. It's going to move backwards to eventually thinking about a works principle in general. And that obviously is going to take you to the garden, and then it's going to take you exactly to what Nick has just said there.
So this is basically the Romans 5 thing, right? So
if the first bit of
Romans 5 goes outward, in other words, Adam and what he brought in through his failure and his covenant, then that's going to have an impact on the second Adam, and the covenant arrangement that he has. Is that 100%, fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's a one very important part of it. But what I was going to say earlier on, is that, you know, you read the Bible. I mean, so this happened to me while I was reading Bonson. You know, this dawned on me, this realization, because there's no explicit mention of a covenant of works there in the garden and so forth. You've got to kind of piece it together, right? And it's not the most obvious thing in the world. And then you go through, you're just reading the story of the Old Testament and you get to Israel and they have just been delivered and it has been by grace. And so, you know, they receive their being in the land of Canaan, obviously after deliverance, and God is merciful to them. And so you can create a strong like story there of this whole, you know, and I think intuitively as sinners, we want to agree, like, you know, God's given everything by grace. So we just have to respond to his grace. And so it doesn't, as you read through Bonson, you read through the story they set up, it doesn't, you know, it's almost like they're appealing to a lot of things that you wouldn't otherwise know to disagree with, that you feel are intuitively correct at some level because you believe in grace anyway. You believe, you know, that it's not by works, and how dare we think we earn anything before God anyway, and you know all of that. You know, so I feel personally that, you know, if I wasn't careful, if I didn't know these things that Klein was sort of shouting from the rooftops, yeah, I would be in trouble. I'd sort of just move along with that narrative and fail.
Can I jump in here and say a word about progressive covenantalism?
Yes, without, please.
Not wanting to take too many shots at too many people, but I'm busy reading a Four Views book, which Horton represents the covenantal position.
Yeah.
Whelan presents the progressive covenantal position. And I mean, we're listening to Klein here and we're seeing him articulate the merit principle, the works principle, the necessity, yes, of articulating the difference between law and gospel, merit and grace.
Yes.
And you know that, you know, we know that there's a long historical discussion on this. And we have it in our confessions. And then you have a progressive covenantal view, which comes into, it's the new kid on the block. It's about 10 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I read it appreciatively. And I think there's a lot of good in it.
Mm-hmm.
The parts that I appreciate are the exegetical stuff. They've taken up the strengths of the biblical theology of Voss, of mm-hmm. Klein, mm-hmm. of Beale, and they've incorporated it into the scriptures. But then they say statements like this: we just have to be careful about saying works in the creation covenant.
Yeah.
And they avoid the language of a covenant of works as if somehow that's wrong. So what they've done at that point is they've just literally cut off the importance of the historical discussion.
Mm.
They've basically moved the whole discussion only into exegetical theology and not historical theology. There's a lot of positive stuff there. It's really, really helpful. Mm. But then they say things like this: you know, every covenant has a tension between law and grace.
Mm.
Yeah, that's the one I hear.
And wow, thanks so much. Mm. It's such a specific statement that's so helpful.
Yeah.
You know, well, and basically what I'm seeing right now is Reformed Baptists will love it and they'll pick it up and they'll take it.
Yes.
And for the first generation or so, you know, it'll continue to serve the system that they're already in.
Yeah.
But I can actually imagine anyone coming up and picking up progressive covenantalism.
Yes.
And actually using it to suit their system because it's not historically rooted. And this is where the confessions are so helpful, and Klein's the distinctions that he's making that are historical are so important.
And even on that point, let's use it as an opportunity to really say that, you know, even 1689 federalism, you know, that would be very, very helpful to, you know, bring out some of the problems in progressive covenantalism. You know, you're because one thing that you can't critique the 1689 federalists for is their strong contrast of law and gospel. And, you know, they won't allow just this monocovenantal blend and blur, even though you know, we would disagree on some other points that we're talking about, in the Mosaic Covenant. Well, not so much actually in the Mosaic Covenant, but you know, anyway, leave that aside. But you know, it's one thing I appreciate them for. You know, I appreciate them for the law gospel contrast that they're upholding. I'd rather fall into that side than any other side for that reason.
And let me just say, progressive covenantalism has a lot of good in it. I read it,
of course.
You know, it's wonderful exegetical tools.
It reminds me of reading Goldsworthy or something. That's what it reminds me. Yeah,
I feel like it's about people whose strengths are biblical theology, not historical theology. And I think Willem does do some good historical theology in his Doctrine of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not showing here. It's untested. It's not historically rooted. It's trying to build an exegetical case for covenant theology without the benefit of the historical discussions, and the categories that Klein's emphasizing are lost.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem.
This is a better footing to begin with.
Exactly. Couldn't agree more. Yeah. And so half of this issue, and you mentioned Vellum, they're trying to find a form of unity, like the, here's the unity of the story. Here's the biblical theology as it unfolds. Here's the bigger picture, right? Obviously, that is the case with the Theonomists. There, even guys like, what's his name? Piper's guy, the Fuller guy, Fuller and Shepherd. I mean, they're just emphasizing unity, right? And they're going, oh, look, they all have some tension. So therefore, it's all united. There was tension in the garden. There was tension after the garden. Tension the whole way through. And one of the things that Klein was so helpful on, okay, because he's, you know, it's almost like they're fighting this battle against dispensationalism that's going, there's no unity, you know, and so they're wanting to show the unity, but they're doing it in this weird way. So Klein goes, by setting apart a law and gospel contrast, you're not compromising unity. You're emphasizing the unified works principle, because that in fact is the unity of scripture, that it is all 100%, as he calls this law priority, you know, that no one gets to heaven but by works, you know. This
sounds
is thing,
terrible, right? But it's 100% true. The covenant of redemption is a covenant of works,
and
the covenant of grace is the covenant of works fulfilled by your representative.
Yeah, and it's funny because it sounds terrible at a very superficial level because, oh, we don't like works, you know, but it's just like, come on, give it a little bit more thought than that, because you, as Klein says, you know, you're allowing like full scale Roman Catholicism to come through the back door unless you emphasize this whole concept of merit at its, you know, overarching unified principle level. You've got to say Christ had to do that. That's why it's grace. Otherwise, you take the very meaning of grace away and make it what Rome has been saying throughout.
You got to emphasize works and merit in order to save the gospel. It is really counterintuitive.
Like it is that. Counterintuitive. Yeah. Now, it took a guy like Klein to really bring that out, though, because you imagine the battle on his hands, you know, because he's shouting works from the rooftops, you know, and it's just like in a milieu of legalism and, you know, and all this stuff, and you can see how people are like, no. But
it's
about response.
Grace. It's all grace. Yeah. It's kind of graciously worksy.
Doesn't it make sense too that the hiss of the serpent's gonna have that angle? Don't worry. But don't worry about confessions. You know, we just want to be biblical. You know, don't worry about law. We just want grace. It's always this like deceptive thing going on, you know. Anyways, maybe it's too much to shoot the serpent's motives upon the Theonomist, but I don't know. I feel like Monday morning anyway, so why not?
Can't hold us.
I'm still on Sunday night.
Monday morning.
Sunday night especially, yeah.
So I was just going to say, maybe coming, leaning more into Klein's response, you know, you point out that he says, Israel alone echoes Adam's covenant of works in the Old Testament. So you've got a common grace canvas, and then Israel gets put onto a common grace canvas as an anomaly, as a unique event, as something distinct. And that, and Israel alone is pointing back to Adam and the covenant of works principle.
Yeah.
And Israel alone also points forward to Christ's eschatological kingdom. So that's a sort of a double emphasis.
Yeah.
That you drew
they become the corporate son, you know? So you got the son of God in the garden, Adam, and then you got the corporate son, you know, they've come out of the watery chaos, right? They enter into the new land of Eden, the land flowing with milk and honey. And now the corporate son is before. And that's why the language of sonship carries on throughout. And then this all to give this ultimate sort of like convergence in Jesus as the son and true Israel.
Exactly. Which is a Christological reading of Israel, isn't it? Whereas as opposed to seeing Israel as a protological theocracy.
It's the first
people of God as a nation, which now sets the blueprints for all nations to become Christian.
Exactly.
No. Read it Christologically. It's Israel is highlighting the covenant of works principle in Adam and foreshadowing Christ. Mm.
And, isn't that exactly what Galatians 3 is saying? Isn't that exactly the point of Galatians 3? That is what the law is doing, is a descriptor of what Christ would come to do and what he would come to fulfill. You know, that he would come in and be the offspring and he would come and be the one who fulfills the law's tutelage the law's imprisonment.
And if you don't get it there, then Hebrews will certainly sink it, you know.
Hebrews will do it. Yeah.
100%. And so if Israel is not a blueprint for how all politics should go, how do we understand the laws of Israel?
Yeah, so so I mean, the thing is, Klein was worried that you've got to do one of, if you, you know, as you just said, you've got this table spread of common grace, right? And then you've got the suspension
God's
of those
ordinary way of dealing with unbelievers is common grace,
right? Right. And then the suspension of these principles in this anomaly of Israel, right? Yeah. Because, why is it an anomaly? Because it is like this intrusion of heaven, you know, yeah, on earth in terms of its typology. It's a proleptical judgment, you know, in a very real sense for not proleptical.
Proleptical. It's a new word. I like it.
Proleptical. Sorry. Like it. a prototypical and proleptical is where I was going there. It is this judgment that is actually not only foreshadowing, but giving almost a foretaste of that judgment to come. You've got the polity itself depends on the Mashiach, the holy anointed ones, right? So like the whole thing is ruled by the anointed one, you know, the Messiah King.
Yep.
So any attempt to set this thing up without the Messiah King is like kind of ridiculous. Oh, it's like majorly distorted is what Klein's saying. So if you want to take, fine, go ahead and take this thing and then set it up in the US, but who is going to be your Messiah King? You know?
Trump,
Trump. You've got Trump. That's an option. But like, no Trump. Oh, okay. Well then, you know, but the one thing that's not an option is taking these rules and laws and just changing them. You can't just like change them. This is the whole thing. Jesus got mad at that. He goes, listen, you've got it. It's ironic because they're going, guys, you're forgetting about the law. We need to bring the law back and so forth. But the only one changing the law are the theonomists. Everyone else wants to keep the law in its perfect form, you know, because you can't just go, we'll have the whole system, just not the Messiah King. Messiah King's a little
too. Which is why it's so frustrating, because, you know, when you hear these guys go on, like on social media ranting about how, like, you know, it's historically unprecedented to build a society not based on a religion, and there has to be a unified religion to be a unified society. And they're talking about there is no other principle upon which human life can flourish. You have to have this kind of a theonomic kingdom of some kind. Mm. And he's like, of course, but it's just not now. You know,
exactly. We have a Messiah King. His name is Jesus. He's coming back, and he's gonna. You know,
guys, we all want that. You know,
exactly.
But you can't just. He's told us he's gonna come.
And you know what,
it.
Frame. You know, to be fair, you know, he came up with this great critique on theonomy. He goes, exactly that point. He's like, listen, you know, whenever you ask a theonomist to just give you the vision, I mean, everyone agrees. They always just go to this eschatology, or you know, and whether you're leaving aside amillennialism or pre or post or whatever, you know. You just jump over that and everyone's in agreement. Like, we all do want that. Like, everyone does want Jesus reigning and ruling and everything to be awesome. But it's like, as soon as you press them on what that means now,
they
shift and shape and do all these things that end up, showing that what they have in mind, they just can't work.
And there's a very convenient narrative serving theonomy right now. So let's take the issue of abortion. Hmm. You know, you've got, abortion is obviously murder. Babies should be protected. They're made in the image of God. You know, all Christians agree on those issues. Hmm. But then in our particular context, you've got everything's politicized to the left and to the right, and Christians should be on one side of the discussion as opposed to the other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we should be seeking for abortion to be, you know, the abolition of human abortion. That's, you know, don't be flaky and be an incrementalist.
Exactly.
You know, you've just got to go full volume all the way into abolition of human abortion. And I agree. I think if I could make, from the ground up, if I could choose right now to stop all abortion, I probably would. Mm-hmm. But then what's the epistemological basis upon which their efforts are resting on? They say, you see, this is what the law of Moses says we should do. Therefore, we should be pushing the law of Moses across the board.
Right.
And of course, we'd say, hang on, the Noah covenant also says murder is wrong. And you don't need the Mosaic covenant to build a just society. You've got natural law to help you with that. And so you don't have to take the whole shebang when it comes to the theocracy of Israel.
Yeah, yeah.
But could you not go a bit further and actually say, look, like, even if you can see the point and say, we need a theocratic kingdom in order to live properly. Like, it's always going to go haywire.
Yeah.
Whether you're
in precatory silence, basically.
I mean, this is basically
we'll always feel displaced in this present age.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is basically like Tom Holland's thing with the Dominion thing, and he's talking about, you know, the historian Tom Holland, not the actor, not Spider-Man.
Okay,
and he
Spider-Man.
Yeah, another guy.
So, and he writes, and his whole basic thing is that if you look at like the Islamic world, or you look at the Greco-Roman world, and you think like Christianity improved the life of people, like in a way that was unprecedented, you know, like, I mean, it Judeo-Christian values really did produce a better society in a way that was like, if you'd be terrified if you went back to the Greco-Roman society, you went back to that kind of Islamic society, like it really was kind of this oasis in the wilderness. But at the same time, like that can never be more than just a kind of foretaste of something. And yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that really I can go all the way with a theonomist and say, yes, I agree with all the principles about what is required for human flourishing.
Yeah.
But that's just not what we are at the moment. We're a pilgrim people now. We're an exile people.
A way to really press that point, I think, and this is the genius of what Klein was doing. Here's one little sentence. You know, if anyone's going to memorize a sentence for his response to Bunsen, then this would be it. In Israel, the eternal cosmic realm received symbolic expression in the land of Canaan. That's,
amen.
You know, so like what I love about that is it like takes it out of the realm of that kind of argument. Like we're not talking about is that true or not? Because if that is true, then that has implications for the way we're going to do theology and reason through these points. As he says, it's sui generis. It was in a class by itself. It's not something that you can, if you do say that Israel was normal, and the other fear was that you sacralize all the other nations as well, and you lose its distinction in that way, and you end up with some other, contrary point. But I mean, this is the difference of theocracy. Of the theocracy and its anti-type heaven from the ordinary institutions is not merely a matter of combination or addition. There is here the appearance of a new species. Yeah. That's the idea right there. So is that true or not? And I think that's where the debate needs to. And then what the theonomists often say is, oh, we totally get it. We totally get the eschatological typology and so forth. But then Klein's response is, well, then where is your holy Messiah? You know, if you get it, then, you know, are you saying that that it's all normative except for the holy Messiah part, which is just completely ridiculous? You know, the whole thing was set up around that idea, obviously, you know, especially by the time you get in the Davidic covenant, you see that really clearly. The whole thing is there to establish, as we said last time, that the Davidic king will obey on behalf of his people and so forth. Yeah. So, you know, it is just, it's not tenable, I don't think, to say that you can just take the rest of it, you know, as normative and then leave that part out as the typological part.
And I mean, you mentioned Klein said that the theonomist is essentially inconsistent because their nomology says that Jesus came to fulfill the law, not to remove one jot or tittle from the law.
Yes.
But to set up a theocratic kingdom on the basis of that law.
Yeah.
And yet they themselves do not apply the jot and tittle.
Yeah, isn't that ironic?
So exactly. Yeah. So when it does come, and I think we've spoken about this example before, but it's worth repeating because I've had a few young guys where you get into these discussions and, you know, isn't the whole world, doesn't every inch of creation belong to Jesus? Shouldn't we be fighting for the lordship of Jesus in every area of the world? I'm like, okay, let me ask you a question. Which is worse, to worship an idol or to murder another human being? Which is the worst sin? Now, they're both damned, but which is the worst sin, you know, in terms of a hierarchy of worseness? Well, an idol, you know, that's the violation of the first and the greatest command. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, mind, strength. Murder is merely against your neighbor, though it is a sacrilegious act because they're men in the image of God and it's ultimately against God as well. Mm. But ultimately, we would say idolatry is worse than murder. So, so do you agree that we should have, and I'd say to them, you know, would you agree that we should have the death penalty for murder? And you say, yeah, of course, you know, it's the law of Moses, da 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 da. I say, okay, so should we put all Muslims to death? Because they're committing the greater crime.
Right.
No. And so suddenly the problem of pluralism.
And then there's a small little issue, you know, of like, wiping the mission field out before, you know, like
and then this is the way they've backed into that now. This is the way they're approaching this. This is their pushback. No. What we do is we go with the Great Commission first.
First, yes.
And then once we get 51% of the nation, we vote, and then
jihad,
we
jihad, baby. Yeah,
and then
exactly.
The army. No. We're post-millennial, so we actually believe in revival. So we just keep plowing on with this ideal future in our minds that God's going to pour out a revival. So we're allowed to pursue this dream because we also believe in revival in the future.
Yeah, right. And that's exactly what Fran was saying. You know, no one has a problem with revival in the future where everyone believes in Jesus. Everyone loves that ending, you know, and we all aim for it. But what does it mean now? What does it mean now? And then it gets all, but. I think that is exactly right.
Yeah.
And you know, the irony is profound because again, you know, you have who now is being the theonomist or who is being the autonomous?
Yeah.
You know, surely if the theo of the theonomist says, do this as, you know, this is my namas, you know, like don't do that.
Yeah.
And you go, no, I'm going to do that. That's not theonomy, you know, at the basic level. That's autonomy, which is bad, not good.
That's such a good point.
When we see the New Testament telling Christians to submit to the emperor, this is not them being silent for the sake of witness. This is the normal Christian life for pilgrims in this present age.
Yeah.
Amen.
But have you seen how that submitting to the authorities, how they've managed to turn that into rebel against the authorities? Have you seen that?
No. Like, I mean, I've felt it, but I haven't seen it. What do you mean?
It's bizarre. Like if you watch for example, James White was
oh,
one
you mean
of the
just like their argument ones? And reasoning?
Yeah, like okay, the way they it, yeah. read Romans 13.
Yeah.
But somehow they turn that into a
exactly
text where you're supposed
point,
to rebel. Like it's like that's definitely not what it means.
There's always been a place for civil disobedience in a Christian understanding of living under an ungodly government.
But now what we do is
we hold the ungodly government to the higher law of the Ten Commandments and the full content of the Mosaic law, and now we have every reason to disobey.
He's God's minister. So surely he should be obeying, you know, he should have taken the presbytery exam.
So there's an assumption, a theonomic assumption, which you have to carry into that, which needs to be exposed.
But also, it was about face masks, which doesn't really have anything to do with anything. So...
Exactly.
So there was
Well, in America, it probably has a lot more to do because they have a... more liberty-based constitution.
But you see, this is why this kind of way of thinking can only thrive in the States, though. It can only do that.
Like Second Amendment, everyone gets the right to carry a gun.
Well, I mean, how many theonomists are there in Pakistan?
Well, what it amounts to is a slightly more aggressive form of social work, you know, I think, you know. So a fundamentalist form of Christianity applied in kind of the social work dimensions, because really that's all you got. And maybe politics, you know, just some attempt to enter into sort of like rallying in politics and so forth. Not because that's all they want it to be, but because that's all you, I mean, that's the only,
that's all you can
what
do.
Else are you going to do? You know, it's just a dream world. Otherwise, you know, you're not living in, you know, you're not dealing with reality, I suppose. It's
sorted out all the Americans' problems. What's next?
Well, I mean, it is a little bit like,
just kidding,
like,
brothers.
With Daniel, you know, in Babylon and so forth, he had a shot at it. He could have just, you know, got into
in
beast. Yeah, he could have just killed the false
Joseph
prophet.
Had a shot at it.
Yeah. Now, they even had a shot at it and totally didn't do it. So it's got to say something. We'll leave that aside for now. But I mean, you know, we don't even have that Daniel Joseph guy. You know, there's just no way. So it's just not even going to be a thing for us.
I'm pretty sure Daniel's thing was, I just want to go home. You know, how long until I can go home?
Exactly.
And surely that's like a good description of the Christian mindset.
Yeah.
It's like, I just want to go home, guys.
I know. I mean, that.
I don't want to make a new home.
I don't want to derail this entirely. But yeah, I think those sections of text, I mean, as soon as you establish some sort of like parody and parallel with the patriarchs and, you know, the Sethites and so forth, and any pilgrims and exiles, basically. With the church, as Peter does, you know, so,
and James.
And as soon as that happens, then you're like, wait a minute. Ah, okay. That's probably the better way to go. And also there's this little matter of, you know, Jesus and allowing the Roman government to kill him.
Kingdom, not of this world. Well,
I mean, one of the constant like one-liner slogans that I hear is, so Jesus loses now?
Yeah. Well, this is where it gets started. But this is where Klein just goes mad, and I agree with him. He's like, listen, if you move in that direction, you disparage the victory of Christ. You disparage the victory of Christ through the weakness of the cross.
Yeah.
But this is the problem with this. You know, you're moving
when
in.
When we are weak, he is spirit. Strong.
Yeah. He says it's terribly alien to the gospel of Christ. You know, when the church presents its evangelistic mission to the world in ways that, you know, talk about political conquests and so forth, it's just not Christianity at that level.
It's like trying to do evangelism and go out there and preach the gospel in the hope that everyone will like you. You know, it's just like, it's the total wrong expectation.
And then when they
what
don't,
will happen.
And then when they yeah. don't, you come up with this whole thing to, you know.
But what does it mean to disciple the nations, Andre, unless you're actually changing governments?
Well, nations, it's governments? About making friends, Nick. It's about making friends. It's about gaining popularity. This is what it means to be victorious.
Because it doesn't say make disciples of individuals. It says make disciples of nations.
And I remember when I just become, I think I was like, I had now crossed the line on Calvinism, right? And so I picked up R.B. Kuyper's book on evangelism and Calvinism and evangelism or something. I forget what it's called exactly. But I'm trying to look
at Lectures on Calvinism.
No. Oh. R.B. Kuyper's, it's something like Calvinistic
Calvin
evangelism
and the Calvinists.
Or something.
Oh, yeah. That one.
You know that one?
Yes, I know that one. Yeah.
So I'm like, okay.
Yeah, I gave it to you. I gave you that book.
Did you? Yes. So yeah. I pick it up and I'm like, yes. I do want to know how Calvinists were going to do this because this is the big thing now. You know, I just like, I've just basically, you know, crossed the line on this thing that I've in as an Arminian, I've just kind of pretty much damned the concept of evangelism. But don't worry, I got R.B. Kuyper's book to look at. So I just open that sucker and get straight into it. And by chapter two, I learned that actually the answer is politics, not gospel. You don't share the gospel. What you do is, everyone's got to get into politics because a nation is Christian when it's political.
System. Everyone multiply. Yeah. Everyone train up your kids in Christian schools, get involved in politics and bring in Christian laws.
That simple. And I knew at that point.
Well, it's easier than sharing the gospel. Let's be honest.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's very tempting because you've got the Schaeferian style of evangelism.
Yes,
you?
Exactly.
But you basically look over history and you say, which strand of history looks the best? The one that's been influenced by Christian politics or the one that hasn't? There you go. Christianity is true. Therefore, become a Christian. And I've snuck in the assumption in order to do Christian politics.
Exactly. Yes.
Except, although if I was reading the book, you know, the edited book by Colin Hanson on Our Secular Age. It was basically a collection of essays on Charles Taylor.
Yeah.
And I can't remember which article it was in the book, but I was listening to it as an audiobook. And one of them was... And one of them is just basically saying, look, you think you want to go back to this kind of medieval, you know, Christianity, but you don't, you know, like, especially Baptists, like, do you not remember what it was like, Baptists? Do you not remember what it was like in under a theonomy, you know?
Right. Exactly.
You know, it wasn't pretty. Like whose version of Christianity will rule, you know, because
Bonson's
it's
version,
not going to be the Baptists.
You know, yeah. Well, that would mean Reformed theonomists and everyone else is kind of, you know, in treason of some sort, you know, which is,
isn't it fantastic
angles.
That we don't have to prove that history would have worked better with our principles, but all we have to do is point to the fact that the Bible teaches this.
So
it's almost like, for me, it's almost like, okay, look, there's a problem with the whole law gospel distinction thing. And there's a problem with the Mosaic covenant and how that's being understood. But there's also a big, like a lot of it is the whole eschatology thing. Like, you know, it is just the expectations of the now and the not yet, the, you know, and what it's going to happen. Like post-millennialism combined with these kind of errors and this way of thinking about the Mosaic covenant and understanding Israel as a kind of like, I don't know, ideal for the world now. Like that is the dangerous combo right there.
Yeah, no, it's true. And you know, they do, I mean, we should probably wrap this up, but they all go theonomist, right? I mean, sorry, post-millennialist. And when you, the reason I suppose I've trained myself not to go there is because then it becomes a debate about eschatology and all the bits about that. And, you know, then they can hide also in the fact that not every, you know, theonomist is necessarily a post-millennialist, and it just gets all, it adds this layer of complexity. So what I appreciate about Kleins, and you know, this is one thing he was critiqued for. He was like, he's just basically assumed everyone's post-millennial, and you know, he's just throwing Bunsen in the same bucket with a million other guys, and he didn't care about the nuances, basically. And you know, that's true. That's perhaps something you can critique him for, but it's also the greatest point of
see the big picture.
Yeah, because he's just like, I don't care about your stupid nuances. I don't care about your things that you want to hide behind. Here's the greater problem. And you know, yeah. I can just stab it in the heart whenever I want, you know. So this is what he did. And this is I think it's sort of left this imprint going forward, and that anyone that wants to sort of argue in this direction really has to come back to this critique. They can't overlook it. They can't just brush it aside. Ultimately, what I've tried to argue anyway is that the back and forth between him and Bunsen and then the later sort of proponents like Gentry just really have not been successful in actually dealing with what Klein was saying. So you might be wrong on some issues, but that heart of it, you know, was something that you have to look at. Otherwise,
and maybe one last point for the pastors, because one of the things that I feel whenever I begin reading the Theonomists is, oh dear, I better go and learn about tax law.
Right.
Oh dear, I better go learn about which is the better political system, whether it's social welfare or you know, libertarian capitalism.
Mm.
You know, oh dear, I better go and learn, you know, so that I've become an expert in every area of life to preach it from the pulpit. And that's like, oh my gosh, you know,
but it is also to
so
me,
far
it just
from
starts,
what the Bible says.
Yeah.
Exactly, and it starts to feel like very worldly. Very quickly, you know, like I know that there are critiques of the kind of, you know, medieval beatific vision and the kind of just so heavenly minded, do no earthly good kind of thing, but the New Testament definitely does have that kind of language where you're just like, guys, put the investing down,
set your minds on things,
you know.
Yeah, we want the sky.
Your life is hidden with Christ in God.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the visible, but the invisible, which is eternal. You know, that's what we are focusing on. So there's definitely that kind of dynamic.
I long to shed this tent so I can get a better one.
What's up?
We're sounding like Plato got a hold of us.
It's Boesma, Mark. It's Boesma. Okay. We have to end every session with a reference to Boesma, and this is where he fits in.
Sorry, I was quoting the Apostle Paul, but you can carry on.
Well,
I know what you were doing.
Alrighty, good. Well, I feel like we brought the heat, guys. You know, we got the sarcasm in there a little bit more than normal. I think we've played ball. You know, it started off a little bit sleepy, but this ended well. So there we go. That's Klein. And theonomy. We'll come back to the theonomy issue when we see what they say against Klein. That's going to be exciting.
That is going to be exciting. I for one am excited.
Stay tuned.
It takes all kinds of men to make this old world go around, but it just takes one with a gun to put you in the ground. I asked for a loan from the big boss man, but he flat turned me down. So I took out a loan with my old shotgun and put him in the ground. wicked and wild, like a West Texas wind, born to be an only rebel child.